Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening to Creative Control. While I have you here, please consider supporting Youth Empowerment and Support Services, otherwise known as YES. Based in Edmonton, Alberta, YES provides immediate and low-barrier overnight and day shelter, temporary supportive housing, and individualized wraparound supports for young people aged 15 to 24. They work collaboratively within a network of care focused on the prevention of youth homelessness by providing youth with the necessary supports to stabilize their housing, improve their well-being, build life skills, connect with community, and avoid re-entry into homelessness. Learn more about how to donate or otherwise support YES by visiting yess.org.
Hi, this is Mark Lee Morrison from the podcast Low Profile. I live in Olympia, Washington with my wife and two daughters, and I support Vish Khanna's Creative Control on Patreon because I appreciate his journalistic integrity. Vish talks with a lot of artists I care about, and he never asks any boring questions. I love hearing his interviews, and as a Patreon supporter, I get to hear even more of them. If you enjoy Creative Control too, I implore you to join me as a sustaining contributor.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Creative Control with Vish Khanna.
Sophie Papamarco is a gifted writer, journalist, and author based in Toronto, Ontario. In her past life as both an arts and lifestyle writer and columnist, Papamarco has contributed to the Toronto Star, the Globe and Mail, the Montreal Gazette, and Exclaim magazine, among others, covering everything from music to dating and matchmaking, and her short fiction has appeared in Tattle Creek and Maison Neuve, among other periodicals. In 2021, Papamarco's first book of fiction was published by Woolsack and Wynne. It's a wonderfully funny, haunting, and poignant collection of short stories called Radium Girl, which recently won a Gold Award in her category at the 24th Annual Forward Indies Book of the Year Awards. After a long-in-the-works plan to chat, Sophie and I recently and finally connected for a talk about life as a new mother in Toronto during a pandemic, why she disabled her Twitter account with its sizable following, how we know each other and our mutual friend Jordan Howard, why she was or wasn't actually a journalist, her entry into the world of professional matchmaking, the stories and recurring themes within them in Radium Girl, working on a novel, other future plans, and more. A part of the Entertainment One Network, with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf at Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is episode 697 of Creative Control, featuring the wonderfully talented Sophie Papamarco with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Sophie. How's it going?
Good. How are you, Vish?
I'm well. It's nice to talk to you. It's been a long time. I said that questioningly. I know it has. Like a super long time, I think. Where in the world are you there?
I'm in Toronto, which is a city in Canada.
Yes. For those listeners around the world, Toronto still is a city in Canada, a city I was once known to frequent on the regular, but have moved away. How are things for you in Toronto today?
Oh, you know, they're pandemic-y still.
Yes.
Despite our best intentions, yeah.
Are you hunkering down? What's your deal generally?
Yeah, I've got a baby who's not vaccinated, so we are hunkering. My partner works from home. Hmm. I don't get out much. We go for walks. That's pretty much it.
Yeah. Now, your baby's not vaccinated. You know, as a parent, is it up to you to sway an anti-vaxxer like that? Maybe turn them around to the right side of the science?
I feel like I've just sort of thrown my hands up at that. You can do what you want. I'm just going to avoid everyone, basically.
Yeah, it's a very frustrating time. And I know, I remember... Because I think are you basically off of, you're off of Twitter, I believe.
Yeah.
What happened there?
The day that Elon Musk, I'm going to get some hate mail from some Elon Musk bros, but the day that he bought Twitter, I was like, you know what? I'm good to go.
Right. Because you were, why I ask is because you were pretty vociferous about pandemic carefulness, cautiousness. How we shouldn't be letting our guard down, and I'm with you. I don't spend too much time doing that stuff, but I'm the same. I feel the same. But and also I should say, by the way, did Elon Musk buy Twitter? I feel like that was just a sham and it never happened. Am I wrong?
Well, not being on Twitter, I haven't been getting the latest information, so I don't know what's going on in the world anymore. Did he buy Twitter? Who knows?
I'm pretty sure he didn't in the end, or he can't or something.
Huh.
Or he's threatening to do it, and it's some sort of market manipulation for whatever he wants to do well, and he's trying to drive the price of Twitter down or something. So as it stands, as we're speaking currently, I don't think Elon Musk actually owns Twitter.
Well, that's good. But at the same time, I felt like I was staring at Twitter when I could have been looking at my kid growing up. So I felt like there were a whole lot of different reasons to just kind of call it quits on that platform.
Yeah. Fair enough. You are missed, if I may say. And you had a significant
Thanks.
Following, as I recall.
Yeah, I had a blue check mark and everything.
Yes. So was that a consideration for you? I know this sounds silly because we're adults, but when you get the blue check mark and you have lots and lots of followers, that can't be the easiest decision to make on the one hand, but on the other, we're adults. So maybe it was super easy.
Yeah, I think I mostly miss the connections with people who aren't on other social media platforms, like my Twitter friends who aren't on Facebook. But I don't feel like I miss anything. Like I haven't felt tempted to sign in yet. And it's been 2 months, which is a significant amount of time having passed after spending 12 years on Twitter.
Yeah.
So I think it was probably the right decision for me.
Well, yeah, no, I appreciate it. I'm sure there are people like me are envious that you can do it because some of us feel compelled. It's hard. It's an addiction, isn't it? Like, it's hard to get.
It really is.
Actually, that's an interesting perspective you can offer. So you did it. What were the withdrawal days like? Were you ever like, oh, I got to get back on there. This is horrible. Or have you been mostly fine?
The first week was weird because I sort of automatically tried to find the app on my phone and it wasn't there. And I was like, wait, what? and my fingers would like type, sort of ghost type twitter.com on my computer. And I'd be like, oh, wait, I don't have that anymore. So the first week was a little bit tough because it was just a force of habit. And after that, it's been fine. I haven't really thought about it very much.
Fair enough. All right. Well, we don't want to talk about Twitter too much. I just wondered about it because that's where all the anti-vax and the anti-science and the everything's fine sentiment, that's where I get most of it, which right. I don't like either. But it's also good to know what people are saying. So you can be like, really? Like, how is this possible that people think these things?
I'm going to miss the jokes. That's what I'm going to miss.
Yes. Yes.
The jokes.
Yes, I do. The memes. It's true. I do like one of my jobs still is to collect funny tweets every week for Exclaim magazine.
And, oh, amazing.
And I enjoy that because that's where that's like every Friday, a little bit of a release valve on how annoying the world is, you know?
Yeah. And that's how I know you. That's how we met.
Did we meet on Twitter?
No, Exclaim.
Oh, sorry. Right. Exclaim. Sorry. I didn't. No, we met it. Did we? Well, that's funny you mentioned that because I have some recollection of you being friends with my friend, Jordan Howard, who I played.
Oh, my gosh.
Is that right?
Jordan and I were in kindergarten together.
Oh.
That's right. Because you were both Guelph people for a while, right?
That's correct. And we would play in a band together. And sometimes we'd play in Toronto. And then sometimes you were there. And that's how I feel like I really got to. Did we really cross paths that much at Exclaim? Because I wasn't physically at the Exclaim office all that often. So when you say we met through Exclaim, I can't recall how often we were kind of in, like at Exclaim parties and stuff. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I feel like the first time I met you was at an Exclaim Christmas party at the Bovine.
Oh, okay,
I'm fairly certain.
Yep, that's possible. Yes, that's definitely something I would have gone to. But yeah, that's funny. Our memories are a bit different. My memory is that I knew you through Jordan and that you would sometimes come to our shows probably to see him. But are you from Guelph?
No.
Oh.
No, Jordan grew up in Scarborough with
right.
me, and then his family moved, I want to say, to Sarnia?
Yes.
That's, when you're older?
Yes, yes.
And we didn't stay in touch. We just reconnected in our 20s. Like, it was like a whole gap of time that we missed, and then we were like seeing each other in the music scene. And actually, I haven't seen that guy or anything in years. And I think is he back in Guelph? Hi, Jordan. If you're listening.
His ears must be burning. Jordan, as far as I knew, based on the last time I drove him home, is in Waterloo.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. But
yeah, we were like the smart kids in our class, and we were sort of like, we'd compete to like be the best readers in our classes because we were in the same class from kindergarten to like grade 5, I want to say. Grade 6 even.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, he's smart. He's a smart guy. I'll give him that. So, that's funny. Okay, so we're kind of connected on a music scene level. That's what we've established, which is nice. But the occasion today is to talk about this wonderful new collection of short stories that you've written and has been published. It's called Radium Girl. Congratulations on this, by the way.
Thanks.
It's been out a while now, right? How long has it been out? I said new, but it's been out a considerable time.
It's been out for a year, since May 2021. So, over a year.
I don't like to start episodes or start apologizing, I should say, this early in an episode. I usually wait 30, 40 minutes before I start to apologize. But Sophie, I want to apologize. I think I reached out as soon as I heard tell of your book about us chatting, and it's just taken a long time. I'm slow. I read slow is basically my excuse.
I had a baby 3 weeks before my book came out, and so I was incapable.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, of forming coherent sentences up until like maybe a week ago. So the timing's perfect.
Yes. As I recall, this is true now. This is all coming back to me. I'm very hard on myself, Sophie. That's the problem. I just assume everything's my fault. But the thing is, yes, I did reach out and then one of your people and I were corresponding, and they mailed me a copy of your book. But then you and I were having, actually, I think we would correspond on Twitter. That's how I know you deleted it, by the way, there, because you're still in my Twitter direct messages. I can, you're there. I see your, you know, account. But then when I tried to message you, it was like, gone. Sophie's not here. And like, it's zero.
What does it look like?
In the direct messages, it looks like you're an active account. But then when I click on it, you're gone. And I sent you a message on there, but it didn't work. So then I think I messaged you on the other one, Facebook, I think. Is that how we reconnected? I think it was. Or email? I forget. I asked you if we could email. Anyway, that's neither here nor... You know, your and Jordan Howard's spelling and reading aptitude, how you and I corresponded, not necessarily germane, but... sort of. I just wanted to, I'm pointing out facts and figures, but you and I would correspond on Twitter and I'd say, I'm sorry, I can't do this right now. And then you'd be like, I can't even have it. Like you said, I can't have a coherent sentence. I'm basically, this baby is taken up somehow. I was not expecting a baby to be so much work. Is that, weren't those your exact words? I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like nobody tells you that babies are hard. Nobody. So, and then you're like, what did I sign up for?
You know,
what is this?
Sometimes our 7-year-old daughter will be really clingy with my wife, particularly since we moved her all the way across the country and then a pandemic happened like 6 weeks later. For some reason, she's clingy. We can't figure it out. But anyway, my wife is sometimes like, I don't know. It's so frustrating. I'm like, what did you think this was going to be? You make human beings, like my parents and I still talk. And they still want to give me advice. And sometimes it's helpful advice. And they still want to like, do you need money? I'm like, you're not even making an income now. And I am. Why would I need your money? Like that instinct of taking care of and just constant. It's the rest of your life. So I say that to my wife sometimes. Like, what did you think was going to happen if we made children? People, they're going to need us all the time. Like, that's it. This is.
They're not like. A cactus.
No, they're definitely not. I said that to her. I'm going to get that on a t-shirt right away, by the way, just for my wife. My
kids, they're not a cactus.
They're not a cacti. Yeah. Cacti? They're not cacti. Kids, not cacti.
They're not cactuses.
They're not cactuses. Yeah. No, I think it's we forget or we don't realize. I don't think we foresee exactly what we're in for when we have our children, some of us. I think I did. I was like, yeah, no, that's normal. It's normal for them to need you for the rest of your lives. That's just how it's going to be, no matter what you think is going to happen. So anyway, yeah. So all I'm saying is get used to it, Sophie. This is just what you're in for the rest of your life.
We're just tired forever.
Yes.
Just tired always.
Yes. Tired and worried. At this point, I know where my children are all the time. In a few more years, I'm not. And that's how I imagine that. Like, yeah, my parents used to stress out. They'd stay up late till I got home. And I always thought they were just guilt tripping me. But I mean, honestly, I can see myself doing that now. I could see
my parents did that too.
Everyone, yeah. I think it's.
I've always felt so bad about that.
Yes, and we made fun of them for it, but really, what the hell? Like, as teenagers in cars with other teenagers, it makes no sense that anyone would be calm and chill about this circumstance. Oh, yeah, you're going out with a bunch of teenagers who've been driving for a year and a half. I'm sure that'll be fine. Have fun. I'm not going to sweat that. Anyway, sorry. This wasn't meant to be about me and my neuroses. This book is really fantastic. First of all, short stories, always a curiosity for me why a writer would go for short stories versus, you know, a novel. How many books have you published thus far, first of all, Sophie?
One.
Radium Girl is the first one, but you are an accomplished and acclaimed, I guess, journalist, right? Is that appropriate?
Content writer.
Content.
I don't know if I think you are a music journalist. I think Michael Barclay's a music journalist. I think Carl Wilson is a music journalist. I don't think I was ever a journalist of anything, really. I think I was a writer.
Okay, let's just figure this out together. I'm going to go to the author bio at the end of Radium Girl. Sophie Papamarco's writing has appeared in the Toronto Star, the Globe and Mail, the Montreal Gazette, Reader's Digest, Chatelaine, Flair, the Walrus, the Huffington Post, Exclaim, Salon, and many other publications, both living and dead. Her short fiction has been published in Tattle Creek, Maison Neuve, and Room. So most of these are periodicals. some of which would be classified as journalistic entities.
They contain journalism, yes.
That's true. Some of them did or do. So I would venture to say that you are more than journalism adjacent. I think you were or are a journalist on some level. Because the writing you would have done for some of these places would be, would you say, was journalism on some? What else would it be?
That's so I'm being maybe a little bit self-deprecating because I've never worked in hard news. And that's what I think of as journalism. I think of it's like research, like intense research and intense like digging and being a detective and investigating. And that's not what I did. I would interview some people about vibrators and then write about that, you know? Right. Like my writing, my journalism was soft journalism. And that's not to say that I'm not a good writer. And then that's not to say that it wasn't interesting to read. And that's not to say that it's not also important to write about dating and, I don't know, relationships and music and pop culture. But like that to me is not true journalism. And so I don't know that I would classify myself as a former journalist.
Okay. I appreciate the distinction you're making, but you also raised another one.
We can talk about this all hour.
Well, I'm just saying I think you are a journalist, and I think the fact that some of those publications would include your thoughts and perspectives on the topics you mentioned, that does count as some form of lifestyle journalism, you know, arts journalism. It's journalism on the one hand. But now that we're going down memory lane, you have written fairly – weren't you kind of known as sort of a relationship or – no, didn't you have like a – didn't you have like a name for yourself or something? You were some sort of like matchmaking person or something. What were you? A dating specialist?
Yeah, I was. I started a matchmaking company. It was called Friend of a Friend Matchmaking. It still exists under new ownership. And I was also a dating blogger back when that was sort of a relevant thing to be. So I don't know, like the 2000s before things got like super dystopian.
Is that right?
And my blog was...
There's no need for dating anymore? There's no need for blogging anymore?
I think dating, blogging, there's no need for that anymore because everyone's had like the funny, weird, crazy stories now. It's not... I was a very early adopter to online dating. Like I started online dating in 2005, which it was still kind of shameful. It was still a thing that people didn't talk about. And I was on all the OkCupids and the... Before it was even called OkCupid, it was called the Spark. That's how far back I go. And I would sort of write about each of these dates in an anonymous blog. And I had quite a following and it was fun and cathartic, I think. And I took my wisdom from that to create a matchmaking company because I thought like, nobody wants to date online forever. I did it online forever. It's terrible. Hmm. I want to meet people organically. So I started introducing people in my life to each other and it went really well. So then I was like, I should make money doing this.
Right.
And there's actually a story in the book, to take it back to the book, about a matchmaker who has some like pretty...
Everyone you love is dead is the story?
That's right.
Yeah.
And the matchmaker has some unethical business practices, let's say.
Is that drawn from your own business practices?
It is not.
Just making sure.
It is not.
I would think when you're in that realm, though, when you're in the sort of matchmaking or dating realm, you know, where it's you're monetizing other people's desperate desire. I don't know how else to put it. That wasn't complimentary. Sorry. But when you're in that realm, do you hear stories about your colleagues?
Yes, I would hear. It was mostly not very flattering stories about the sort of more corporate matchmakers, the ones that aren't attached to people, that sort of have more, you know, like elite matchmaking, Toronto Gold Star kind of stuff, instead of like, hey, this is Debbie and she's a matchmaker. Because when it's an individual and they tie their name to it, I mean, Friend of a Friend Matchmaking was just like a cute name, but my name and my face was all over that site. And I was very transparent about it being a one woman show.
Right.
And it being very human and very authentic and very transparent. But there are a lot of matchmakers who are pretty decent people and they try their best. And it's just, it's a tricky thing to be because people are, I'm not sure if you know this, Vish, difficult.
Yes.
And people have expectations that don't necessarily match up with reality sometimes. And you have to try to figure out a way to make them happy while sort of dodging some of those expectations.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for instance, women would often come to me and I'd ask what they want in a partner, and the first word out of their mouths would be tall.
Right.
And I would have to say, well, you know, there's only 10% of men are 6 feet and above. Should I only be looking at 1 in 10 men for you? Should I be dismissing all those other guys? And then they'd be like, oh, wait. So there's a little bit of massaging there.
Why? So just so we're clear and on the record, I'm tall. I'm 6 foot two. Why do women, in your estimation, care about tallness? Why does it matter to them?
It's the same reason why a lot of men care about thinness, I think.
Hmm.
And that is because it is what a society deems attractive, or at least Western society deems attractive. And B, it makes people feel more comfortable in their own bodies, in their own skin. Because for me, like, I'm a heavier woman and I wasn't always comfortable with that. And so I always dated taller men because that way I didn't feel big compared to them. They were the big one.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And for men wanting slimmer women, sometimes it's like a skinny guy that makes them feel like the man, quote unquote, in like a hetero relationship. So that's sort of like my thought process around it. It's an insecurity thing more than an attraction thing.
I see. Well, I feel like all your background as both a matchmaker, as a, and I'm just going to use the term again, journalist. I feel like you...
Fine, Bish. Fine, I'm a journalist. Fine.
I feel like you have been very immersed in the study of human behavior. And a lot of your research, if you will, comes shining through in the various stories in this wonderful book. As a catch-all, can you... And again, every story is different, set at different times. There's some science fiction sometimes. There's all sorts of genre exploration that goes on from story to story. But on a human behavior level, does that interest you? Do you feel like you were trying to explore things that have been bothering you about human beings with Radium Girl in particular?
Yeah, I think it's fun to explore the psyches of people that who you are not. It's sort of like a nerdy role playing in a way. What would I do in this situation if I were this certain person, or I had this kind of past, or this was my goal? But I think the overarching theme that I was working with that became apparent after a few stories was loneliness. Every single person, every single character, as different as they all are in the book, is extremely lonely and feels like isolated and like an outlier. Or they're trying to help people who are isolated and outliers. And that definitely came from like the headspace I was in my 30s, because I wrote this book from age 33 to age 37, where I was mostly single.
Yeah.
Well, I was actually in one bad relationship for a year during that, but it was definitely my exploration on themes of loneliness and trying that out in different shoes, I guess.
Definitely different shoes. So for those who haven't yet dug into the book, the first story is about it's about conjoined twins, and that is fascinating on a few different levels. What compelled you to ponder that dynamic as it relates to, I think it's obvious probably, but why were you interested in conjoined twins?
This is going to sound like super nuts because it's not apparent in the story, but I started writing that in November of 2016. So for me, it was about a being divided, where one half of the being was acting in a way that was actively harming the other half for their own selfish or ignorant reasons. So for me, it's about the United States of America. And these women are two different sides of that. And that was me exploring it on a more human level.
Oh, wow. So it's a political allegory. I hadn't even picked up on it.
I know. Nobody does until I explain. I guess it's maybe just how I worked it out in my head before. Like, it was something I needed to talk about and explore. So I did it through conjoined twins who are teenagers, just figuring out their lives and how one of them harms the other irreparably through a selfish act.
So interestingly, and I think one of the reasons I didn't pick up on that necessarily, I recognize that they were opposite sisters. The sisters are sort of opposite in their ways of thinking. Mm-hmm. However, the story is set in Canada. It's set, the sisters are from, as I recall, New Brunswick. They relocate mm-hmm. to Toronto. They end up working at Honest Ed's, which is a now defunct, garish bargain place for bargains and
palace.
Weirdness.
Bargain
yes,
palace.
Bargain palace. Yeah. I had not occurred to me before you just talked about it. Was Honest Ed a stand-in for Donald Trump? Carnival barker? Kind of, you know, trying to rip people off?
No. I just really liked Honest Ed's, and I thought it was such an interesting backdrop, and I wanted to set a story in it. And there, that mannequin room exists, and I wanted to integrate it into
No.
Well, it existed.
And I appreciate that this is, it's not maybe all connected in terms of the allegory, but if you've got conjoined twin sisters representing, if not the Democratic and Republican Party, but the left and the right, I like the notion now. You know what? I don't even care what you say. In my mind, Honest Ed is Donald Trump now. Or maybe some of the boyfriends are Donald Trump, or the boyfriend, the guy. Anyway, I don't want to ruin anything, but that is an interesting opener. All I'll say is that for a story, because I'll tell you what I did. Sophie, I've had a lot of time with your book, so I read it once. And then last night, I read the whole thing in one go. I read the whole thing. I stayed up late. I like to read until I can't read anymore, until the book hits me in the face because I'm so tired. And it just wouldn't happen. And as a result, I had a weird dream, a nightmare that it's, I don't normally, they're not that vivid, but I think because of all the weird stuff that goes on in your book, I had a nightmare that a mass inoculation was purposely corrupted to not work.
Whoa.
So I don't know what that's about. There is some stuff going on in this book. Which is the story about? Is it Ark? What's the story about the people who held hostage by someone, basically?
Oh, yeah. That is something to cry about.
Something to cry about. Right. Anyway, the landscape, because they're short stories, and then, oh, my God, in heaven, everything is fine. I was telling my wife about that one today.
That's a creepy one. That's my shot at horror.
Yes. So, and I don't want to spoil anything, but I also don't want to leave people listening being like, what the hell are they talking about? You have, what I'm trying to get at is you seem to have a real interest in whatever modern means as this book ages, but you seem to have an interest in technology, in how humans interact with technology, how it, messes them up, a little bit. These inventions of ours, they come back to haunt us, I think, is some sort of thread running through this book. When I think of the story White Cake, for example, where someone's using their ingenuity but they're oblivious to certain things, and then they end up, I don't want to spoil anything, so I'm being careful, but they are underestimated and then they get their revenge. But it's all about their ingenuity, and it's all about using the tools that we as a society have presented each other with. Anyway, I just find that interesting. Do you know where I'm coming from with that?
Wow. Like, I never really thought about that, but I think that's really interesting. And I hadn't really thought about the technology parts of the book. And that really all leads to Sophie quitting Twitter.
Yeah, exactly. The control burn, if you will. I mean, you had to burn your Twitter down for the health of Sophie. It's not a great analogy, but it is interesting too, because I find that, and I don't know if this is purposeful, but there are very few instances of sympathetic male characters. They're mostly all horrible. Flip side is that the characters who identify as women are completely, you know, you feel sympathy for them. They have to battle through some form of adversity or another. In some cases, because of men. Is that as obvious to you as it is to me? Is that something that you we're kind of going for here and trying to tell empowering stories that that speak on behalf of women?
It really didn't hit me until I read the full collection. And I thought, oh God, I seem to have a bit of a misandrous streak here, because there's only really one character that I can think of who's actually like that you're really rooting for, and that's Marcus, and he's a child.
Yeah.
In terms of men, right? And there's Richard in the same story, but he's flawed as well. But honestly, I do think that probably my favorite character in the whole book, you haven't touched on this yet, is in Tiny Girls. He's the protagonist in Tiny Girls.
Oh, you like that character.
I think he's charming and endearing, despite being a non-practicing pedophile, which is sort of what I was going for.
There's a certain, yes, you have created a non-practicing pedophile who somehow comes across noble and conscious of their illness. That's a really interesting take on that. Why? And I mean, there's a lot of cases here in this collection where I think you're giving sort of some evil people the benefit of the doubt, and perhaps even not advocating for them, but trying to see their point of view a little bit, or trying to offer their point of view and their perspective on things. That's a rare kind of empathy. But why? What possesses you to do that exactly? To try to make untoward characters sympathetic to the reader?
I think in general, there's no such thing as a truly evil person. I mean, we could argue about this, and we could say, "Oh, Hitler." I mean, maybe, but I think overall, people who cause harm to others do that because there was harm done to them, and that doesn't justify it, but that sort of recasts people as, like, our friend Donald Trump. His dad was a dick to him.
Yes.
His dad was a tyrant, and I think a lot of his bravado and arrogance comes from his, like, painful, neglected, privileged background of just trying to prove himself to daddy and never quite adding up. That's my sort of psychological analysis of Donald Trump. So when you look at him that way, I mean, you can still loathe the guy, but you can see sort of a more human element, and you can understand how he is the way he is. And it comes from pain. And for me, I'd like to explore that side of people. And for, in terms of like the non-practicing pedophile, that was like a pure rip on Lolita. Like,
right.
Lolita is my favorite book, probably one of my favorite books, because it's just so, it's gorgeous writing, and the character is so sympathetic despite being despicable. And I wanted to sort of try my hand at doing the same thing. How do I take somebody who's so loathsome and turn him into somebody charming and likable and you're almost rooting for at the end? So that was an exercise in like, how can I do this too? That looks fun. Let me give it a shot.
Margie and Lou?
Yeah.
Is it Lou that alludes to the fact that she just wants to read Nabokov?
Yeah. Good call.
Yeah.
Good catch.
Yeah. So where I'm coming from though is, and I don't mean to psychoanalyze you, and I don't want you to admit anything that you don't want to. But what I'm getting at, I think, is what little I know of you, and I mean, we know each other. What little I know of you, I'm starting to sort of wonder if you're in each of these characters, or how much of you is sort of reflected in these stories. It could be that little nod to Nabokov. It could be, you know, earlier you were saying that we were talking about how people try to date certain body types to make them feel good about their own body type, and I can, there's some body dysmorphia type stuff going on, or judgment going on about the way people look. And, you know, I mean, again, in Heaven, Everything Is Fine has this hilarious punchline about being nagged by your parents. I mean, it's this crazy horror story, but in the end, what's the goal of it? Well, it's because your parents are relentless shamers, and you just got to get used to that. Anyway, so there's shame, and there's all these things, and I know there's a lot of different feelings. There's revenge, all sorts of things, superpowers. But do you feel like you're in here a lot, or am I extrapolating too much?
No, I think that's very insightful. And I feel like my experience and my body and my life are the only ways that I have experienced the world. And so, of course, there's a lot of me in each of those characters, because that is how I've experienced the world. And like, even if I'm trying to be somebody else in my brain or in my writing, there's still going to be like the weight of my entire life and my psychology enmeshed with these people's brains and with these people's motivations and with their thought processes. So, of course, yeah, I think if you ask any writer, of course, they're part of each of their characters.
Hmm. It's a bit of a stock question, I suppose. One of the things I often ask people after they've put a record out or put a book like this out is I say, did you learn anything about yourself? Now, following that last line of questioning, do you finish any of these stories and come away from it with any perspective about yourself? I feel like you do. I feel like you have the power in sort of doing that self-exploration that you're just describing. You have the power, as the narrator, to change the ending, to make it the end. You know, a lot of us, I don't know about you, as you get older, you sort of reflect upon your life and you think, oh, what if I did this? Or what if I talked to that person in high school and said this? You know, every once in a while you have those thoughts. And I think when you're a writer and you can sort of reimagine those scenarios, but put them in kind of a fantastical way, you can write the ending you wish you'd had. You can, you know, for someone else. Do you have any of that? Do you have any of that, like, oh, I resolved something that I was feeling or that something that was bugging me about a regret or something I had. I was able to resolve it just by putting that in the story. Do you have anything like that happen?
I mean, I haven't had any of those experiences that those people, that those characters have had. However, certainly, like, I've had the emotions that they felt, and like some of it has been extremely cathartic. Like the burning of the house in Controlled Burn. Like, how many women want to do that to an ex-boyfriend who jilted them? Like, so many. And it just felt great to have her actually, like, literally set fire to... Sorry, I don't want to, like, give away. It's sort of an obvious moment, I think, at the end of that story. But, yeah, I think that there's a certain catharsis in writing a story and having a character get revenge on something that you have maybe experienced, whether it's shame or feeling like an outcast or being heartbroken, and having that happen in like a spectacular sort of dramatic fictionalized way feels great. Sure.
That's a really fascinating story though, because...
Which one? Control Burn?
Control Burn. Yeah. So let me just, again, I don't want to spoil anything, but it's worth talking about. I'm going to try to summarize it. Sophie, please correct me or interject if you feel like I'm wrong, but... This is a story about a young woman whose parents feel she's overweight. However, she becomes the object of affection of an older man. And as the story develops, the parents say, hey, to the daughter, we're actually going to send you to like a fitness camp because we feel like you need to lose the weight. And so she's separated from the man that she starts basically dating, who seems interested in her, for both her spirit and her physicality. And as she begins to lose the weight and become conventionally beautiful, if you will, the man loses interest. So some predilection this gentleman has for people who in society wouldn't be considered as beautiful because they are overweight, so to speak. I'm trying to speak gingerly about this, as you can imagine and tell. Probably. But that's an interesting story because this gentleman who does not... I'm going to stop it there. What do you want to say about this gentleman? Because on the one hand, what we learn is everything I've just said is true.
Right.
He has a preference for women that are, well, A, very young, I believe, which is villainy, but B, seems to appreciate women who are... what's the term that people use? Rubenesque? Larger.
Fat. You can just say fat.
I can't say it. So he seems
not a bad word, Vish.
I know, it's not a bad word, but I feel like it's derogatory. Sorry, I have my own hang-ups about words like that, and I'm so it colors my ability to use them. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Growing up in the 80s and 90s, Yeah. Kids were very mean. And you would, I feel shame and horror at things me or other people said to others. And so I am, it's not about being politically correct or woke. It's just about being decent. And I don't want to, it's the other thing I used to do, and I was just talking about this with someone else, is I would use the derogatory word for people of East Indian descent against myself. So mm-hmm. that the white kids couldn't do it. So all I'm saying is I have some regrets. I couldn't have known much better. I was a kid. You make mistakes. You say things. Yeah. The conventions at the time.
Do you remember saying that's so gay as like the worst thing ever? And it just makes me, like, it's Pride Month now. And it just makes me feel so much shame and so much sadness for the kids who knew that they were right at the time. Yeah. And it was such a common phrase in the 80s and 90s.
Yes, but I could be wrong. There's probably documentation. There wouldn't be documentation. What am I talking about? There was no way to document these things at the time. I don't remember using that word in that way. I just never, idiot, stupid, probably fat. But I just don't remember. I can't be sure of this. Probably, you're right. It was so commonplace, and you just talk like your friends talk, and that's how it is.
Or the R word? Did you ever use the R word?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Oof. Right. So all I'm saying is I can't say that word because it has some baggage for me. My point is this guy who seems to have some, what's the term? Well,
preferences.
Yeah, sure. Let's say preferences. That's the word. So he's prefers women who are younger and larger than others. And he's the villain. So the younger part I get. But I guess what I'm getting at is, interestingly, the guy who doesn't seem to conform to conventional modes of beauty is still the bad guy on some level in this story.
He is to her because he hurts her. He breaks her heart. But would you, like, everyone who's told me about Pete has been like, I like that guy.
Okay.
You know?
Well.
And that's what I tried to do. He's a predator. He's a clear predator.
He is a predator. So that makes it bad. And the fact that he just dumps. He doesn't explain himself. He just, the young
ghost
girl.
Sir.
Yeah, he ghosts her and then starts.
Ghosting was a thing.
And then starts dating, or whatever, dating. He's a predator. Starts grooming another young woman who looks more like. Sorry, what's the main character's? The woman, the young girl?
Lily?
I don't
remember. It's been a while.
Yeah, you should. Yes, forget it. Anyway, he ghosts her, and that's bad. And he also is a predator. That's bad. And he seems creepy. He approaches her at a candy store, and he seems to. Yeah, I think he is bad. He's a predator. And he knows his. Okay, is that fair?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, I'm a journalist. He's a predator. It's up for debate.
It's an interesting way of telling that story because Lily's revenge is against someone who saw. No, there's no way to talk about it. I don't know what to say about it. He's a predator. So the revenge is probably justified. It's just those beauty conventions is where I think things muddy it up for me on some level.
Right.
Like, is he? But again, most of the men, terrible. They're almost all the men are terrible. Some of the boys, maybe not as much. But some terrible stuff goes on.
But Vish, the women are mostly awful too. Like, I'm an equal opportunity villain writer.
Sure.
The women are awful.
Who's the worst woman in this story collection?
Who's the worst woman?
We just were talking about Lily who sets fire to a guy's house. That's pretty bad.
She's lovely. I love her.
Yeah, she's fine.
The worst woman in this collection. It's probably the matchmaker.
Yeah.
Maybe. Who do you think?
I don't like Annie from White Cake. Something wrong there. Taking advantage of poor, naive Carol. Carol, I believe, is her name. I feel like you wrote Carol like a character in a Kids in the Hall sketch. One of the Kathys. Do you know those characters? Bruce McCullough and Scott Thompson, sort of office naive.
Totally.
I don't know if you're a fan of that Anyway, that's just weird.
Yes, I'm as a teen of the 90s, I am a fan of Kids in the Hall, yes.
When I read White Cake, it's the perspective is all Carol's, and she talks in a way that reminds me, it's a very Canadian way of talking. I don't know how else to put it. There's something kind of hosiery about about Carol, and Annie, some not right there. I don't like that. That's just one opinion. I don't know why is this a line of questioning? Who is the worst person in your book? Let's talk about the worst person in your book. Well, it's just
Well, we have murderers, we have pedophiles, we have the obvious worst person in the book is the father in Something to Cry About.
Yeah.
To me.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
racist, controlling.
Yeah.
Psychopath. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But is it PTSD from his time in the military? Question mark. Can we find a soft spot for him?
Here we go again.
Did he have his heart broken by his wife?
This is the Donald Trump thing that you did before. Right. Let's get to the pain to figure out where the anger is coming from.
Yeah.
And it's noble of you, but but there's nothing good about that character.
No,
anyway,
he's still a dick for sure. Yeah.
Absolutely. So I think there are lots of horrible people in this book. Radium Girl is a really fascinating, that's the name of the collection. It concludes this story collection. It's a bit bizarre. Can you contextualize it? Can you summarize what that story is about and why it became the titular story?
Yeah, it was the last story I wrote for the collection. I had no idea what the collection would be called. And then when I finished that story, I was like, oh, that's what it's been all along. So the Radium Girls are, I'm not sure if there are any history buffs listening, but in the 20s, 30s, even up to the 50s, there were young women, generally women from immigrant families in the United States, who worked in watch factories, primarily painting dials on the watches in radium paint, because when soldiers were in the trenches, I mean, they didn't have, their iPhones to check the time. They had their glow-in-the-dark watches with radium paint. And these young women would paint these watches like they were paid per watch, so they would paint very quickly. And they were taught to lip point the tip of the brush, so they would have a really sharp point and that would like accurately paint the numbers. Hmm. But nobody told them that radium is incredibly poisonous. And many of them died of cancers and horrible things as very young women.
Yeah.
And I only learned about this a few years ago, and it enraged me. I was so infuriated at the injustice. They took the ones who were sick and dying, as opposed to the dead ones, took their corporation to court and tried to get some damages from it, but it was a really difficult uphill kind of journey for them. And I wrote Radium Girl out of my rage for the injustice of that. Mm-hmm. And I tried to, as we've been speaking of, get some revenge on their behalf in a fictional way.
Yeah. 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 It's another example of what I was alluding to earlier of women being placed in bizarre and harmful positions due to industry. And technology. And I guess there's a triumphant ending. It seems
to me. An optimistic ending.
Yeah.
It's a superhero origin story.
Yes, exactly. So does that suggest we might hear more from Radium Girl at some point in our lives?
I would love that. I would love to turn her into a comic book or a movie or a miniseries.
Yeah.
I would love that. I think she's a perfect feminist superhero of our time.
You should connect with a comic book artist and see if you can't get that off the ground, because I think there's some legs there, if I may say.
Yeah.
Who am I to
tell? Brian Lee O'Malley, are you listening?
Yeah, exactly. We got to find someone like that. Yeah, they'll do it, I bet. Yeah.
I'll email him after I say bye to you. Well, thank you in the acknowledgments.
Thank you. Appreciate that. So I hope we've given people a flavor of this collection. I hope we didn't spoil anything. Is there anything more you want to say about it in terms of what people can expect or what you hope they take away from it once they've read it?
Well, I feel like I shirked your original question of like, why are the men in this book so terrible? And because I just went, oh, the women are awful too. But to be like fair and honest, they are terrible because I had a terrible time with men in my 30s. Hmm. And our art often reflects our experience, as we have already spoken. So yeah, there were a lot of terrible men, because I had a lot of terrible men in my life during that period of time. So apologies to the many, many lovely men out there. I have one in my life now. I have several in my life now, and I'm happy. And men are people, just like women are people. And sometimes they are terrible, and sometimes they are wonderful. Yeah. And wonderful people rarely make interesting fiction, though. So,
yeah. No, I appreciate there's got to be
tension. I think the takeaway for your audience is please buy my book. It's Canadian publishing.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I hope they will. And I'll link to it so that they can figure out where to get and stuff. Do you want to shout out your publishers and whatnot?
Yes. Thank you so much, Woolsack and Wynn in beautiful Hamilton, Ontario. You have been a dream indie press to work with. Oh, and I just won, Radium Girl just won gold in the Forward Indies, which means they thought it was the best short story collection of last year.
Oh my goodness. Great. Congratulations. When did you win that?
2 days ago.
Oh, what the heck? I didn't even know that. Let's just, for the record, our talk was scheduled before I knew you were going to win a bunch of stuff.
I won a thing.
Congratulations.
That's one single thing.
That's incredible. So what is that? It's an award. You get, what is there, like a cash prize? You get coupons? What do you get?
Again, Canadian publishing. There's no money in it. I get bragging rights. I can talk about it on podcasts.
Oh, well, I'm very, very happy for you. That's amazing. And it's well deserved. As I say, I've read this book twice, once in one sitting. Gave me a slight nightmare, unrelated nightmare, I'm pretty sure. But no, it's wonderful. So what's next for you, Sophie, now that you've won an award? That sort of pins the tail on this donkey. What's next?
Continue to keep my daughter alive, mm-hmm. and hopefully COVID-free till she gets vaccinated. That's sort of like priority one.
Yep.
And after that, I'm working on a novel casually, and I hope that sees the light of day in the next 2 years.
Did you find that when you thought about writing a book, did you choose short stories first because you thought, oh, this will be a way to get my feet wet, then I'll go for the novel? Or is it just organic? This is just how it unfolded.
Yeah, it was pretty organic. I think maybe some of those stories were starting to be novels. Or it was like, I'm going to write a novel about this. I was like, nope, it's done in 12 pages.
Right.
This novel is done. It's a pretty great, I have to say, for people who in the pandemic had a bit of pandemic brain and couldn't really focus for very long. I have to say short stories are like the way to go. They're the way to get back into your novel reading.
Yeah.
People tend to be down on short stories for some reason.
I think
it's like, oh, I don't like them. I like novels, but like they're just mini novels.
Yeah, I know. I think people don't give them the weight they deserve. It feels like, I don't know what that, it's like in music, if someone puts out an EP, you say, well, when's the album coming out? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know what that says about us or why, but it's just something that happens. But all this to say, it's really amazing. Sophie, where can people go to learn more about Radium Girl and you using computers, telephones, these sorts of things?
You can go to my website, which is www.myfullname.com, but I don't need to spell it, I don't think, because it's probably there on the screen.
You could say it. I just don't want people going to myfullname.com.
www.sophiepapamarco.com.
Yeah. Okay. There you go. And that's it. You're off. Or are you off most other socials?
I'm on the Facebook and I'm on the LinkedIn.
Right. Okay.
Because I feel those are safer spaces, not because of the, you know, ownership being super ethical or anything. It's just a way to stay connected to people professionally and personally. Maybe I'll be back on Twitter one of these days. I don't know, Vish.
No, it's fine. I think everyone's going to follow your lead eventually. So don't sweat that. Well, in any case, Radium Girl is out now. Sophie, this is a wonderful, wonderful book. Thank you for this chat. I hope you enjoyed it, and I wish you the best luck in the future. It was nice to catch up.
Thank you so much, Fish. Take care.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh.
Fresh.
Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Oh, like I just said, very special thanks to Sophie Papamarco for appearing on this, the 697th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available wherever it is you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode you're looking for, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit my website, vishkhanna.com. You can also like Creative Control on Facebook or follow the show on Twitter at vishcreative, or you can follow me on Twitter and on Instagram at vishkhanna. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to sustain this podcast. $6 or more a month grants you access to exclusive content, some of it derived from the interviews I do now. Some of it comes from my audio archives, interviews I did in the time leading up to actually launching this podcast, things that maybe had a home on my college radio show or magazine interviews that I never got around to putting anywhere else. It's a rich archive of stuff. And sometimes I put stuff up. And Patreon's about the best and most direct way to support the show financially, if that's of interest to you, to support me in this work. Otherwise, there's no other real income for the show. Not enough to live off of, certainly. It would be great if that were the case, that it would pay all the bills and feed me and my family and all that sort of thing, but it's modest, just like me. Is it immodest to say you're modest? I feel like it is. Anyway, thanks for all of you who support the show already, and if you're thinking about it, patreon.com/creativecontrol. Oh, if you'd like a Creative Control t-shirt, there are two designs. One is red. It's got a giant depiction of my head in profile on it. The other is a pizza, like a yellow shirt with a pizza design. If you'd like one of those, just message me on Patreon and I'll get you one while supplies last. I must confess, I'm a little behind because there's an envelope shortage and I couldn't get one. I can't, or the ones I need. I got like 3 or 4 shirts I got to send out as I'm speaking to you, and I haven't been able to get the right envelopes. They don't have any. So I managed to order some online. They should be arriving from Canada Post shortly. I'll get those shirts out. So if you want a shirt and you support the Patreon, message me at patreon.com/creativecontrol and I will hook you up. Thank you. Thanks again to Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee, each located in Guelph, Ontario, and Grandad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario, for their in-kind support for this show. Thanks as always to Jim Guthrie for letting me use some music of his on the show. You can learn more about Jim at jimguthrie.org. Finally, thank you very much for listening to this episode with Sophie Papamarco. I hope you were intrigued enough to check out her book if you haven't done so already. Thank you for listening to this show, subscribing to this show, following this show, whatever it is you do, and telling your friends about the show. It all helps a lot. I will talk to you very soon. Thank you. Bye for now.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.